Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Dineo for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. Right now, it has just gone 6 minutes past six. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, and welcome to the first business show of 2025. I trust you all had a pleasant 2024 year end and a break. The festive break was a busy time. I hope everybody was safe out there. And we're going to kick things off this year doing things a little differently. It's a new year. Why not start off with a new thing? I've been thinking about what we usually do on the show around some of the historical events that took place on this day, and I thought we'd do something a little different this year. We're going to try out a couple of new things, see what works and see what lands. But today, what we're going to look at is strange rules from around the world. Did you know that it is illegal to feed pigeons in Venice? It has been illegal to feed pigeons in Venice since 2008, and the reason for that is because, according to the lawmakers in Italy and Venice, it is too expensive to clean up after the pigeons, and on average it costs the taxpayer 275 euros per taxpayer per year to clean up after the pigeons, whether it's from a damage perspective or just cleaning up in general. And interestingly enough, there's a fine associated with this law. If you're found to be breaking this law, you could be subject to a fine of between 80 and 775 US dollars. I wonder if the fine varies based on how much you feed the pigeons. Interesting law, strange laws from around the world. We'll look at those throughout the year and see if we can figure out why they're in place. But as I said, you're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, and on the show today, we take a look at the latest developments from the EV space. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has signed in, amongst other things, legislation around the EV space, offering tax incentives of up to 150% for EV production taking place in South Africa. We're going to speak to the Automobile Association of South Africa around that and the possible impacts of that on that sector. Then we've also got a conversation with Denker Capital's Corky Koyman around the sanctions that were imposed during the festive a break on Capitec, some 56 odd million rand in sanctions for breach of the Financial Intelligence Center Act by Capitec, according to the South African Reserve Bank. We're going to look at that and see what it means for the banking sector. Are more banks expected to be fined, and what you and I need to know ahead of anything that could come out of that? And then we've also got a conversation around the crypto landscape. Cryptos have been all the rage, especially since the president-elect of the United States, Donald J. Trump, has come out and seemed to be quite positive or quite a big proponent of crypto. Bitcoin has had quite a bit of a rally towards the end of last year, but we've also seen some crypto regulatory changes take place in South Africa and around the world. We're going to reflect on the crypto space in 2024 and see what the space holds for us in 2025. Then we're going to wrap up the show with personal finance. We're going to be taking a look at how to start off the year right, how to get rid of that December hangover from a financial perspective, and how to better prepare your finances for the new year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
If you know by now, you know that we kick off our show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. We're going to start off with the market movements throughout the day, but also take a look at a general outlook for the year, as this is the first show of 2025. I thought it would be a good idea to just take a look at what our expectations are of the year that is, or the year that lies ahead. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager and director at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at the market movements. Good evening, Gary. Welcome back from the holiday. Lovely to have you back. You and I spoke just before you left for the holidays that we would potentially be in for a Santa rally, as we have been accustomed to in the past, that period just after Christmas, just before the new year, finishing off the year on a strong note. Not only did we not get a Santa rally this time around, we actually saw that the JSE finished weaker than when you and I finished our conversation. What happened?
Yeah, 100%. So a little bit unusual. You also normally get that stronger currency, and the currency went completely the other way this year. And that's markets for you. As soon as you think that you've got them worked out, that's when they teach you a lesson. So, yeah, so the currency obviously weakening significantly over the period. We are coming back strongly today, however. But you get the sense that maybe everyone just felt the markets had done a little bit too much for the year, maybe a little bit of profit taking into the end of the year as well. You know, obviously always on much lower volume. So if I look at the 1 year numbers, still, you know, it depends when you start your Santa rally, because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's that very quiet period over Christmas. But a lot of guys say, you know, from kind of November, that's when you need to be buying markets, October, November, and you get that Santa rally into the end of the year. So that the last 3 months of the year. And if you look in US dollar terms, I mean, both the international markets, the US market specifically and tech specifically did exceptionally well last year. So if I'm going to rebase all of this into dollars, because it's sometimes difficult for people just to go and compare if they Google this stuff, but the Nasdaq over the last year up 51% in dollars, the S&P 500 up 26% in dollars, and the JSE All Share, and this is in dollar terms, not in rand terms, and this is even accounting for the little bit of weakness in currency we had towards the end, still up 18.5% in US dollars, which is pretty strong when you consider the likes of the Euro stocks or the whole of Europe, their largest 50 companies, only up 8.7% in dollars. The likes of the FTSE in the UK, FTSE 100, only up 8.8, and investors in Australia, unfortunately, which you know, the price return was only just under 3%, but it's a very, very heavily dividend weighted index because it's got a lot of banking stocks in there, a lot of miners as well that do sometimes pay special dividends. You know, total return over the last 12 months, only 6.7%. So really the standouts have been actually SA. SA has done exceptionally well, even though we did have that little bit of a fizzle towards the end. And of course, tech and the US and the U.S. focus that we've seen, I suppose, with markets getting very excited with Donald Trump coming in.
Speaking of Donald Trump and the markets, obviously when we look at these markets, as you said, Gary, it's important to look at things contextually. But today alone, we saw an announcement coming out of the U.S. in the early hours of their morning, rather. Well, not really early hours, but earlier in their morning before their trading day officially started. That was about lunchtime hour time that sent markets into a frenzy. I mean, I look at the top 40 gained almost a full percent in that 1 hour alone when the president-elect of the United States, Donald Trump, announced that, of course, they're looking at some one single law to introduce, or universal tariffs to introduce, and they're looking at specifically everything except critical imports would be subject to a tariff. And that obviously had markets moving quite a bit, and I thought we would have a good movement from that throughout the rest of the afternoon, and the rest of the afternoon was nothing but a letdown, and it continues.
Yeah, so a little bit all over the place at the moment. So again, we're definitely seeing the idea of a protectionist administration coming in the U.S. You know, Boeing, you know, tech stocks, S&P 500, anything that's listed and operating in the U.S. Seen as almost going to have an advantage because there's this political dispensation coming in behind it that's going to improve things. So we do have the Nasdaq up 1.7% at the moment, S&P 500 up 1.2%. So U.S. markets definitely liking the announcement, but it's quite a confusing announcement as well. So, you know, obviously Donald Trump campaigned on the idea of this universal tariff, you know, maybe 10%, maybe 20%. Nothing was really put down. And today there was a little bit more clarity coming out that this might not be the universal tariff that he talked about, but instead it's going to be more of a sector-based tariff in which it will be universal, but it's going to target sectors that need it. And I think the concern has been, certainly for market participants, is what the impact of a universal tariff is going to do to inflation in the US. So if you just, you know, put a 20% import tariff on anything moving to the US, that's obviously going to stoke inflation. It's one of the reasons that we've seen the expectation for rate cuts from the Federal Reserve coming down as aggressively as they have at the moment. So right now, the meeting on the 29th of January, there's about a 90% chance of no change. And if you look all the way out to the 10th of December meeting, the probability is, so the 38% probability, which is the highest probability, is that rates are only going to be 25 basis points, so 0.25% lower than where we are now. So very, very subdued. You were looking at maybe one, maybe two rate cuts, maybe two rate cuts and a rate hike, but a much, much more subdued path for monetary policy over the next year. And a lot of that has to do with the tariffs that are coming from Donald Trump. Now, suddenly you adjust that from a universal tariff to say, wait a minute, we're going to do this on a sector by sector basis, and anything that is key to economic or national security might see reduced tariffs. And I think the big concern has definitely been that a universal tariff will push up the price of food in the U.S. It'll also push up the price of cheap consumer electronics, which will be very politically unpopular. And we know a lot of Republicans have almost rallied against this, saying this universal tariff idea is not a good one. So essentially, if they do switch it to more of a sector-based tariff, that still solves the issue of individual country-based tariffs. So The challenge in the first Donald Trump administration was that you might have imposed the tariff on China. All China would do would, let's say, export the goods that they wanted to get into the U.S. to Vietnam. Vietnam wouldn't have the same tariff regime in place, and they'd be able to get goods into the U.S. Just by essentially looping it through a third geographic jurisdiction. A sector-based tariff gets around that. So that, I think, is the idea that this is maybe a little bit of a looser implementation of the tariffs, and it's not going to be as inflationary. I think that's why markets are getting a little bit more excited. But all of this is unconfirmed at this stage as well. And sure, in markets where there's smoke, there's fire, and you buy the rumor, you sell the fact. But none of this is confirmed at this stage. And it's still very unclear, obviously, Donald Trump coming in on the 20th of January. And it's definitely not certain what this is going to look like at this stage. So it's still very early days, and we'll see how it plays out. But I think it is one of the key themes for 2025 is watching the Donald Trump administration and kind of moving from one news announcement to the next.
I think the bigger key theme in 2025 is whether or not Donald Trump actually cares about what we say. We've seen in the past that the president doesn't often listen to markets or listen to reason. He comes out, he says things, and then it's for everybody else to figure out thereafter. Gary, before I let you go, I want to take a look at, of course, the rest of the developments around the world. You mentioned, of course, that the US policy is a bit uncertain here. We also know that the Chinese policy was uncertain last year, and the People's Bank of China came out with a statement saying that they are looking to improve consumption in China and stimulate the consumption environment in China. Your thoughts on that and what that could potentially mean for global markets?
I think it's definitely a good thing. China is a complex economy, and the People's Bank of China, so their central bank, essentially has a lot more levers than, let's say, the South African Reserve Bank or the Federal Reserve or even the ECB, in that they can adjust many different individual rates. They can also set quantitative objectives. They can influence the way that banks what banks' loan books look like, and they have an enormous amount of control over the Chinese economy in how it allocates resources. And what we've had from their policy meeting that was, I believe it was the 3rd and the 4th of January, is this desire to reform this. And I think it is going to be a key theme in 2025 as they move more towards a more traditional monetary policy, where they have that single rate tool that they apply to the market. And I think that's going to be a good thing. I really do. I think it's going to lead to a little bit more transparency. It's going to bring it more in line with international standards. And hopefully, if they do end up cutting their benchmark rate as well, that will stimulate the Chinese economy. And of course, countries like South Africa that are very are key to our performance is key in how the Chinese economy operates is incredibly important for us. It will be a positive thing for the South African currency, I think, and the South African market in general. I think the one thing just to note is China is shifting from a very commodity-hungry giant to a very service-driven economy, and that is changing. So the idea that we're going to get our resource sector bouncing aggressively, or we might see much higher commodity prices, and we know higher commodity prices are very linked to our local currency as well. That might not be the case. We might see the stimulus and the development of the Chinese economy outside of things that South Africa applies, which I think will be a little bit of a concern and something that we've got to think about as a country.
Lots to think about, and certainly a busy year ahead. I mean, we've only just started the year, but it does sound like we could be in for a lot of decisions and a lot of adjustments. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Gary. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Gary Boyson, Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, joining me to take a look at how the markets kicked off the first full trading week of 2025 and what we might be in for the rest of the year.
Bitcoin cracked $100,000 over the last week, hitting another all-time high that pulled a ton of altcoins back to life, with some gaining 3 to 400% in a month. My name is Shivan Mudli. I'm the macro strategist at 88, and I'll be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast this week to discuss the latest developments and what's likely to happen in 2025. Please join us.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za. The MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We have our own little crypto update coming up a little later on in the show, but for now we're taking a look at the latest decision by the South African government to aim to bolster the automotive sector in South Africa, particularly focused at electronic vehicles, hybrid vehicles, and everything in that space. The President of South Africa has recently signed into law a tax incentive that looks to make that sector a lot more attractive. That tax amendment was proposed in the national budget last year in February, was finally signed into law on the 24th of December by the President, alongside a couple of other things he signed on that day. We're glad he found his pen. I'm joined on the line by Eleanor Mavimbela, who is the spokesperson of the South African Automobile Association, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Eleanor. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by understanding the tax amendment that's been signed in by the President. What does the bill mean for the automotive sector?
Good evening to me and to your listeners. Well, firstly, it means, for instance, the automotive sector is quite crucial in South Africa's economy because of the number of people that it employs, as well as the amount that it feeds into the South African GDP. So this incentive is going to essentially accelerate domestic production of electric vehicles and its components and the like. And this would mean then it would boost economic activity in South Africa. We've been reading over the past couple of months of how the automotive sector has been, especially in terms of manufacturing, has been scaling down. We've been reading about retrenchments, manufacturers scaling down and leaving, disinvesting from the country. So this means that then it will push vehicle manufacturers to retain their space in South Africa, as well as to maybe even expand in South Africa. It also means that then if we were to broaden this incentive, it's a good thing for South African consumers. If towards the end of this incentive, maybe perhaps as some other elements would be brought in, would be to provide consumers with incentives that would also open up the EV industry in South Africa.
Eleanor, when we look at the EV industry in South Africa, there's a lot that still needs to be done. I mean, you touched on the fact that some of our local manufacturers, or some of the even the international companies that have had local manufacturing operations in South Africa, have been scaling back those operations. We know the likes of Toyota have wanted to increase their EV spend. The likes of Ford, the likes of Volkswagen have all previously said, we want to be able to develop these vehicles in South Africa because we like the conditions that we have in South Africa. But there has always been a lot of policy uncertainty that has kept these bigger companies on the sidelines and sort of away from investment. Now that we're certain here, investment in these areas typically comes with, as you said as well, job creation and the improvement of jobs. Do we anticipate that we've already got countries looking to move some of their investments or some of their production into South Africa? Off the top of my head, I'm thinking of the likes of China that have previously stated that they're willing to invest.
Yes, definitely. There's quite a number of quite much interest, with, especially with regards to China coming to invest in South Africa, especially with regards to the automotive sector, with regards to electric vehicles. We've seen internationally the market moving mostly towards electric vehicles, and it means that then our exports that we've been manufacturing in South Africa have been obviously been scaling down the past couple of months because of the move in the automotive sector. So we definitely hope that this incentive will assist the South African automotive market to open up in terms of electric vehicles, and to open up in terms of looking at other avenues to generate money back into South African GDP and creating more jobs.
Eleanor, some of the other challenges that have existed in this space, or just in the South African space in general, when we look at these companies and we look at the investment these companies have made, has been around infrastructure and logistics. I'm thinking about, from a logistics point of view, some manufacturers have their plants based in Roslyn and Gauteng, and not necessarily in the Eastern Cape, where it's easier to get to port. How do we see the logistics framework shaping up now that the minister responsible for that has come out, Barbara Creasy has come out to announce that we are looking to potentially have private users using the existing railing infrastructure beyond just Transnet? Is that a good thing that works out in that favor?
I definitely think it is a good thing, because when we look at this, there's quite a lot of work that's going to be need to be done in terms of infrastructure and logistics in South Africa, in terms of trying to open up the EV market. And we definitely do think that then the step that the government has taken with regards to the tax incentive is a step in a good direction. In terms of how then the logistics and the infrastructure are going to roll out, obviously we have to expect that it's going to take quite a bit of time. It's not something that's going to happen tomorrow, given that in terms of the infrastructure, we're not quite ready, because it's not something that we've been dealing with in the last couple of years or so. We have, unfortunately, not manufactured any EVs in South Africa as yet, as far as I'm aware. So obviously, with regards to infrastructure and logistics, it's going to take quite a while for that to happen. And I do think that making use of the readily available infrastructure for other uses, to keep it operational, and to, especially to keep people's jobs, especially also to keep the automotive sector robust, is a step in the right direction.
Speaking of infrastructure, do we know if this incentive extends towards infrastructure development? I'm thinking of things like EV stations, charging stations, and that are obviously going to be needed locally if we hope to get this sector off the ground. Do we know if the incentives extends to that?
As far as I know, the extension only goes with regards to machinery, plants, infrastructure such as production of the electric vehicles, and not necessarily the accessories that come with the production in terms of like charging portals and the like. And as I was saying in the beginning, that I really do think that then this tax incentive that has been signed into law needs to open up into with more layers, as to, because there's other components that need to be considered for the South African automotive sector when it comes to especially to the EV sector. It should not just end here. It should to broaden to other sectors to be able to build up the automotive sector with regards to EVs. So and unfortunately at the moment the incentives only speak to the machinery and the plants that will be used for the production of the electric vehicles.
Well, that's certainly going to be an interesting thing to see how that shapes up. And as we look at that, I mean, the likes of China have already announced that they're looking at investing in the 27 billion rand, a billion dollar sector. But we'll leave the conversation there. Thank you so much, Eleanor, for the time and for the insights. Eleanor Mavimbela, spokesperson of the South African Automobile Association, joining me to take a look at the a tax amendment signed into law by the president on the 24th of December that says that EV production in South Africa will now come with a 150% tax incentive.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience, it's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We move on from matters of incentives to matters of penalties. In December as well, the South African Reserve Bank announced that they would be imposing a 56 million rand penalty on Capitec Bank for what they considered to be non-compliance with certain provisions of the Financial Intelligence Center Act, the FICA. I'm joined on the line by our resident banking specialist and director at Denker Capital, Kokkie Kooyman, to take a look at this and see if we can understand the implications. Good evening, Kokkie. Lovely to catch up with you. A pleasant New Year to you, and hopefully a very good 2025 ahead. Let's start with the penalty announcement itself, seemingly catching some people off guard, but Capitec also coming out and saying from their perspective that they don't necessarily agree with the administrative sanctions being imposed on them. What do we make of that?
Yeah, I think firstly, the penalty itself is small. It's 56 million rand. I mean, for most people, that's not small. But for a bank the size of Capitec, profit for the year, let's say, is around roughly 13 billion rand. So, yeah, 56 million is a 0.05% or something. It's a very small amount. And the language of the Prudential Authority used as well is not condemning. It's actually... but make no mistake, the lapses, if correct, and I'm sure you know there will have been lapses, is always serious because it is a serious matter, especially us wanting to get off the grey listing, So yes, number one, the two types of lapses that occurred. The one is non-compliance with regulations, and that is the necessary, call it due diligence and opening of new accounts. And everybody, all listeners know the slip of having to open an account, of doing a transaction, proving your identity, proving your proof of residence, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I think Capitec, and I'm just assuming here, the size of the new branches, new staff growth means they're obviously training might have not been adequate. I don't know. But there have been lapses in that, and it's quite easy, I think, to happen when you've got a bank that size. The other one is non-reporting of certain transactions. When a certain transaction goes over a certain amount, then they have to report that, and it seems that there were lapses there. I'm not quite sure. We haven't been able to get a hold of Capitec yet to find out exactly what it is, but I wouldn't be too worried about it. Obviously, the key is that Capitec is aware of it, will be redressing any deficiency found, and the follow-up inspection will obviously focus on that. Bear in mind as well, this was 21 and 22. 21, it was the retail bank, and 22, it was the business bank that were investigated. And it's a long process of the report being written, the Prudential Authority then writing back to the bank, sending the report to the bank, sending a reply. And so that's why this takes so long. The good thing, I think, for listeners is, and citizens of South Africa, is you can see the machinery and the workings behind the machinery of the Reserve Bank doing everything it can to ensure that the financial system is safe, and they investigate each bank and make sure, you know, that the regulations that are important to keep our money safe is being complied with.
Kokkie, you brought up a quite an interesting point around the grey listing. Obviously, this is the year we aim to get off that grey list. We know that we have a couple of opportunities to do that throughout the year. From a banking perspective and from a financial sector perspective, we've definitely seen the likes of Saab and the likes of the FSCA and the likes of SARS being on a very concerted effort alongside institutions like the Prudential Authority to make sure that on the financial side of it, things are looking a lot cleaner and a lot better from a money laundering and those sorts of other concerns that FATF had with us. Where do we stand from a grey listing perspective now following this particular kind of sanctions or these kinds of penalties being imposed? Is this something we could likely to see other banks being going through?
Yeah, it's interesting. Last year we saw a few of the smaller banks being found guilty and penalized, and Capitec is the first one of the larger banks. I'm sure, judging from the time lapse, the 2 year or the time period between the initial investigations and the fining, the other banks will also have been investigated. I cannot imagine that they will get 100% score. So we'll see more of these. I think what's important for the grey listing is that the international authorities can see that the Reserve Bank and the Prudential Authority, in this case, the arm which does the work, actually does that. It does inspect the banks. The banks are fined and follow-ups are done to make sure that lapses are rectified. So I think that's an important one. On the grey listing itself, I think the problem, the remaining problems were more to do with the investigative authorities, that not insufficient number of crimes were reported were seen to go through the courts and convictions that followed. And I think that was more a problem that seemed to have been the issue. So we'll see during the year now, early in the year, as the Hawks keep processing more cases. But I think that is the important thing. I think the banks, insurance companies, even initially a problem was with the property companies as well, were a problem. But I think generally they get a fairly good auditable on that score.
Kokkie,
so I think we're still on we should still make it by the end of the year. Let's hope so.
Kokkie, do you think a lot of the grey listing pressure is being placed from the financial side of it? Because at the end of the day, whether we're looking at real estate, whether we're looking at the legal side of it, it doesn't really matter what other sectors we look at. The actual transactions and the movement of money takes place in the financial sector with the authorized dealers, with the banks, and with the financial institutions. Do you think that's why it's important to get that sector right first and foremost, more so than other sectors?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like I'm challenging to run a 10K race on Saturday, but I say, I'm going to put weights around your ankles. Yeah, it's going to slow you down. So it's the same. There are weights around our ankles on the financial sector, which just slows down financial transactions and makes them more costly, makes them slower, especially when it comes to international transactions. And so for that regard, I mean, the key for South Africa 2025 is we must do everything we can to actually reduce red tape, reduce regulatory burdens, make things more efficient. And this is one of them that will help. It's obviously only one, but each one will count. And this is one where we can easily do something about it.
Kokkie, do you believe that the banking sector, in terms of whether it's red tape or legislation and adjustments, do you think the banking sector needs to be a little bit bigger? I mean, we've got the 3, 4, 5 big players that we kind of know of at this stage, and we've got the likes of the smaller players that are whether delisting in the case of Sasfin or still struggling to come out of mutual bank status. Do you think we need more players in this space so that it opens up the banking and financial sector space a little more?
Short answer, no. but it's a huge debate. Look, I mean, the point is you do want smaller banks, you do want challenger banks, and it's also just to make sure that you don't develop an oligopoly, large banks who work together. But banking's become such a complex industry and so expensive in terms of technology and so important in terms of the economy, that you run the risk when you allow smaller banks who then open the country up to risks of fraud. We've seen it with VBS, we've seen it with the Building Society or Mutual Society in Natal. We've seen it with the Post Office Bank. Banking is technology heavy, and so in most other countries, Canada's only got three large banks. Brazil has actually only got four large banks. Yeah, so many countries have a number of, let's say, three, four large banks, but then do open up to smaller banks to just allow the challenge. In South Africa, we've got, obviously, Sasfin has had its problems, but you've got Capitec, you've got African Bank now coming back, you've got Michael Jordan's
Bank Zero.
Bank Zero. You've got Time Bank coming through all over. So there are enough challenges, but it's always important to keep those challenges and enable them. And the Reserve Bank there, I think, has been very good at giving licenses where the competence can be proved. I think that's the most important. You, as a bank, to be allowed into the system and take deposits from the public, the public must know that its deposits are safe. And that's why, you know, it's very important to have a healthy banking system.
A healthy banking system is definitely needed. It can also be argued that having more players in this space could open it up for financing smaller businesses better. But we'll leave the conversation there. Corky, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Corky Kooiman, a director at Denka Capital, on the sanctions that were imposed on Capitec and what it means for South Africa in its efforts to get off of that grey list.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Speaking of red tape, at some point these were considered taboo or illegal cryptocurrencies. Now they're considered a financial asset, financial product, and they are regulated in South Africa and in many other parts of the country. We're going to be taking a look at the crypto landscape for the year ahead, as well as what happened in the year that was 2024. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of Valor, Farzam Hessaini, to take a look at this and see how we make sense of it. Good evening, Farzam. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with a recap of the 2024 year. Certainly a busy year in the world of cryptos.
Absolutely. Lovely to be with you, Jimmy. 2024 was a very big year for the cryptocurrency space. As we're talking right now, the price of one Bitcoin is trading at about $102,000 and about 1.93 million rands. So we're just shy of the 2 million rand mark for a single Bitcoin. Obviously, the prices have increased significantly in the past year off the back of a number of events that have happened. The first is the fact that the U.S. ETFs were approved actually nearly a year ago. And so a lot of institutional money in the United States flew into this asset class. We also saw, as you said, in South Africa, CASPs being licensed. CASP is a crypto asset service provider. So the FSCA, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, now regulates these service providers within South Africa. And as you said, a couple of years ago, crypto assets were actually declared financial products in South Africa. And we see many more people also entering the crypto space. Valor just hit our 1 million user mark about a month ago, and that was a user growth that's doubled from about 500,000 about a year ago. And if we look at the asset prices, we're talking about an industry that's grown from about 1.6 trillion US dollars about a year ago to $3.6 trillion today. So it's more than doubling. This was across the asset class. Obviously, we've seen the $100,000 breached after the election of Donald Trump, because he's been very pro crypto recently. Previously, he was not, but his position has changed. And then we've seen a lot of institutions coming in, as I mentioned. So it's been a, a very big year for the cryptocurrency space. And, you know, it's important to note, if you look at all the assets in 2024, two of the top three performing assets were actually Bitcoin related. The first, the highest performing asset was MicroStrategy, MSTR, listed in the United States. It had a return of about just over 350%. Then the second was NVIDIA, obviously the chips and the AI, what's really backing a lot of the AI plays around the world, that had a return of about 170%. And then Bitcoin, over 125%. And MicroStrategy, the top one, is actually been doing very well because it is based on holding a lot of Bitcoin itself. So two of the three highest performing assets in 2024, Bitcoin related in some way.
I remember skeptics saying Michael Saylor is an absolute nutter for going after that much Bitcoin. Clearly, they are all eating their words at the moment, as his net worth is probably around the $9 billion mark now, following MicroStrategy holding around, I think, 101 million more Bitcoin than they did previously. But let's move on to the regulation side of it, because you touched on that, Farzam, saying that there's a lot of regulation that has changed throughout the world, with the likes of ETFs and that coming into the space. In South Africa, at some point, there was a clear ban from the South African government that pension funds in South Africa are not allowed to be investing in this type of asset class. Do you think it's time for those sorts of conversations to potentially be revisited now that we have got clearer direction, we have got markets that are, or areas in, around the world that are saying we're happy to regulate the space, and maybe pension funds could benefit from having access to things like Bitcoin ETFs?
Absolutely. So basically, since January 2023, actually, so 2 years ago, there's been an explicit prohibition on crypto assets being included in pension funds in South Africa. This is based on a regulatory framework that was put into place by National Treasury. At the time, they said it's a very volatile asset, and therefore, you know, it's prudent not to expose pensioners to this asset class. I think, you know, since then, we've seen a tremendous increase in the price of Bitcoin and crypto assets. It will still continue to be a volatile asset. There's no doubt about that. And the, you know, pullbacks are definitely possible and will occur. But I think the main thing that we need to change within South Africa is the option for these assets to be included in some way or form to people that may want products that have this type of exposure. So right now, that option does not exist at all. So I personally am not proposing that, you know, crypto assets should go into every single product everywhere. Not everybody wants them, and that's perfectly fine. But I'm proposing that those that do want them should have at least the option that they're included in financial products that could assist, and in my view, that will actually improve the performance of pensioners over time. So I'm hoping that over time, as we see that regulations in other parts of the world have actually welcomed this asset class, that we do the same in South Africa. And we have done that in many ways. We've got a regulatory framework that's one of the best in the world in South Africa. We've declared it a financial asset, which is great. So there is a little bit of a dichotomy here, because it doesn't really make sense then if you're a society that says this is a financial product, but then you as a regulator say, but it cannot be included in pension funds. I think that needs to be revised so that the people can decide that for themselves.
I think the long-term effects of that on pension funds is probably what still has the government very apprehensive. But again, that'll be something for the governments to decide on and hopefully adjust depending on how they see fit. Farzam, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on the outlook going into 2025. Do you think we're going to see a continuation of the kind of crypto rally or the crypto moves that we've been seeing towards the late or the tail end of 2024? Or do you think that we might see a bit of retracement and a bit of pullback?
I personally think longer term, it's very difficult to say over, you know, a 12-month period. I think longer term, I expect the crypto asset prices to appreciate much more than where they are right now. To put that into context, if we look at gold, you know, gold is an asset that's been around in society for over 5,000 years. Gold had a pretty good year last year. It appreciated 27%. And if we look at Bitcoin as an asset class versus gold, it's still just a fraction, you know, about a ninth of the market value of gold. And I think in time, there's a very good chance that Bitcoin overtakes gold's market value. And so if you look at one Bitcoin, what the price of one Bitcoin would be to equate the market value of Bitcoin to gold, one Bitcoin would have to be about $899,000. Is that going to happen in the next year? No, I don't think so. Is there a chance that we're going to have a pullback over the next year? There is a chance. But I always say, I don't think this asset class right now is for people that are saving for next month or even 2-3 months from now. But if you have money to put aside for a few years, I think over, you know, there's no 4-year period that Bitcoin has not appreciated in value ever since it's been created. So I think it is an asset class that requires patience. It requires the stomach for a tremendous amount of volatility. And if one doesn't have that outlook of a long-term horizon, one can be burned by short-term volatility. So very difficult to say where it will be in 12 months. But my long-term forecast is that we're still expecting to see a lot of appreciation.
Always the debate with a new asset class, where it will go, how it will stick around, whether or not it will stay around longer than others. But we'll leave the conversation there, Farzam. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Farzam Ehsani, who is the CEO of Valour, joining me to take a look at the crypto landscape, how it performed in 2024 and how it could perform going forward.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we start off the year with a personal finance segment that I think might just help us throughout the year, help us start the year off on the right note. We're going to be taking a look at how to recover from the December hangover and how to financially plan for your January going forward. I'm joined on the line by Certified Financial Planner at Fiscal Private Client Services, Johan Rousseau, to take a look at this. Good evening, Johan. Thanks so much for taking the time. December is typically very different in behavior from December, the month itself, especially when it comes to the financial spend. And typically we enter the 16 months or 16 weeks of January thereafter, because January just feels like it drags on for so long. But how can we do this differently this time around?
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners. I think, firstly, compliments of the season. To start off, you know, December is not a month. It's a state of mind in South Africa. You know, the beer tastes a lot better, it's a lot colder, the vibes are going, and you know, people are enjoying their well-deserved time off. But with December, you know, the inevitable January comes along, and you know, you all of a sudden wake up, you've got 50 rand that leaves you for that you need to live off for the rest of the month, and you need to plan accordingly for that. And I think the main thing that we can do in our personal finances is to plan ahead for next December. That's sort of the first step that you can have a look at, is to plan better for the next time this comes around. Another quite helpful tip that I can give people to do is to face the music. I think the first step to recovery is acknowledging the situation that you find yourself in. It's worth it to, you know, take a deep breath, review your bank statements, look where you might have been overspending, and, you know, any debts that you might have incurred during the month of December, and do an honest assessment. Have a look at your finances and see how and where you can prioritize, and, you know, see where you can improve your financial situation for the year ahead. My first tip that I would say is to try and create a simple budget for January and the next couple of months. Categorize your expenses, you know, try and determine what's essential expenses, what's non-essential, what needs to go into debt repayments, and allocate your remaining funds accordingly. You know, this visual representation that you get will help you make more informed financial decisions down the line.
Johan, you've said quite a bit that I want to dig into, especially around some of the little tips and handy things that you can put in place to prepare for the next December. But in between all of this, I mean, January is typically a month that does feel quite stretched. It is something that you want to get through. And it's also a good time, as you said, to put in place to do some reflection on what your December spend looked like, and also what your planning looked like coming into January. When we're in the month of January and you are now reviewing some of the things, right, is this a good time to introduce things like New Year's resolutions around things you don't need. So cutting back on some expenses, or perhaps deferring some of the expenses, or even reviewing some of the subscriptions that we all love to take on at a moment's notice.
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, the first thing is to set yourself some New Year's resolutions. Find out, you know, what you want to achieve in this year. And the first step that you can take there is trying to trim the fat, have a look, have an honest look back at your financial situation, do an honest assessment of your finances. And, you know, as I said, trim the fat, try and cut back on non-essential spending. You know, while it might be tempting to continue the festive season splurge, in January, it's normally a time to tighten the purse strings a little bit. You know, evaluate your spending habits and identify areas where you can cut back. I know from my personal circumstances and, you know, from dealing with clients, a lot of us have subscriptions we no longer use, for example, or, you know, we might have insurance that we haven't reviewed in a couple of years. It's very important to go through your budget with a fine-tooth comb and see, you know, where and how we can trim the fat a little bit and reduce the expenses accordingly. You know, and a very handy tip that I've sort of seen is that they call it the 30-day rule. So if you wait 30 days before you make a non-essential purchase, you know, just have a little bit of a pause, wait for 30 days. And if you still need this item after the 30-day pause, you know, then by all means, go ahead and purchase it. But in many, many times, you know, if you don't need it immediately and you just take a little bit of a step backwards and you wait for a couple of days, you know, then that something isn't an essential expense that you need to pay. And another useful tip I'd say is, as I said, you know, review your bills and expenses and subscriptions. There's many times that, you know, you're paying for something that you might not have used, whether it be a streaming service that, you know, you might have used once in the last couple of months. You know, see if you actually still have that subscription going off your bank account, because it might be a couple of hundred rand, but, you know, it does add up in the bigger scheme of things, especially in a month like January, where you're trying to, you know, trim the fat and, you know, tighten the belt a little bit. And yeah, I think, you know, another thing is, don't be afraid to ask for discounts, and don't be afraid to review stuff like your insurance premiums, like your Wi-Fi bills. You know, many times, you know, if you've got a good track record and you can go to the service providers with that track record and say, you know, can you review my premiums? They're more than willing to come to the table. So that's another useful tip that you can have a look at when you know, facing the trials and tribulations of January.
And I suppose those 100 rands or so that you are saving here and there, you can always redirect towards things like savings and that sort of thing. Johan, I want to look at the shift that we're seeing. We spoke about the fact that a lot of people should be reviewing their spend and adjusting to the new year. There's also a separate conversation that's been had in the past around people wanting to increase their income. So adjusting this expenditure side of the budget is one side of it, but increasing and adjusting the income side of it is something else that people can explore. Would you recommend that side hustles be looked at in this new year?
Absolutely. If it's at all possible, you know, doing a side hustle, having some extra income coming in, it can make a really, really big difference. And it doesn't need to, you know, replace your salary or your income completely, but just a little bit helps, and it goes a long way. We're seeing quite an uptick in people, you know, joining the gig economy. You know, there's numerous opportunities to earn extra income. You know, you can do some freelancing, you can do tutoring, you can sell some products online or rent out a spare room. You know, you can, you know, do help with delivery services, those kinds of things. There are many, many ways where you can increase your income to help sort of alleviate some of the pressure on your budget. And, you know, if it's at all possible to, you know, align these side hustles with your skills and interest, you know, you can build a sustainable business on the side that can actually supplement your income quite nicely.
As Johan said, December is a state of mind. The beer certainly does taste better during that month, but we are no longer in that month and we need to plan ahead for the 2025 year. Speak to a financial consultant, get some advice around the best way to draw up the budgets, the best way to unlock some of the tips that Johan has mentioned so that you can make the most of the 2025 year and have an even better December at the end of this year. We'll leave the conversation there, Johan. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Johan Rousseau, certified financial planner at Fiscal Private Client Services, joining me for this week's Personal Finance. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Dineo Motaung is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.